And here we are again anew with Mark Curtis's book, Secret Affairs, British Collusion with Radical Islam, Serpent's Tail Press. And chapter 18, Alliances of Moderation. There's a couple of times where he gives explanation of that, so I'll read those first. To counter Iran and the broader challenges to Britain's energy security, Britain also resorted to constructing what then Prime Minister Tony Blair called an, quote, alliance of moderation, end quote, in reality, part of London's increasing reliance on Sunni forces in the region. And the second one, the British government continued to see Saudi Arabia not only as a supplier of oil and buyer of British weapons, but also as a Sunni counter to a resurgent Shia Iran, part indeed of the supposed alliance of moderation. This continuing support for Riyadh was instructive in light of what the Saudis were actually up to. So, chapter 18 begins. By the last years of the new Labour government, the challenge to the British and U.S. position in the Middle East was unprecedented in the post-war world. In Iraq, the occupation turned into a disaster for Anglo-American planners, while in Afghanistan, a resurgent Taliban bogged down British forces and inflicted increasing casualties. Iran and, to an extent, Syria remained independent regimes, unwilling to follow Western policies, with Tehran threatening to acquire nuclear weapons to challenge Israel's nuclear monopoly in the region. In Israeli-occupied Palestine, the democratic election in January 2006 of the rising force of the Sunni Islamist group Hamas, the West's, quote, bad Palestinians, end quote, challenged Israel and the secular Fatah Palestinian faction, now the, quote, good Palestinians. In Lebanon, Hezbollah militias attacked by Iran inflicted a military defeat on Israel following the latter's invasion in July 2006 and continued to confront the pro-Western government there. These developments challenged overall Western hegemony in the Middle East, which remained of primary importance for its oil and gas reserves. Of the three major oil-producing states, Iran was an official enemy, Iraq was out of control, and Saudi Arabia's future was, as ever, uncertain. Only the fourth producer, tiny Kuwait, was run, as ever, by a dependable pro-Western regime. A rising Iran, and specifically the overthrow of Sunni dominance in Iraq, amounting to the first Shia takeover of an Arab country, threatened to topple the order imposed in the region by the British after the First World War, an order characterized by the dominance of Sunni monarchical regimes on which Britain and the U.S. have long relied to promote their interests in the region. So that, again, is in the book, the gist of the book goes back at least 75 years, something like that. Here mentions the First World War. So it's helpful to remember when you see the current news or have trouble understanding why someone could behave like that or why they can seem so crusty, is to realize that these patterns and these behaviors are, you know, are entrenched and they go back. And so that's what the amount of extra work it takes to for change and the natural forces of evolution and such like. Confronted with these challenges, Britain under Tony Blair and then Gordon Brown pursued two key policies. First was to follow U.S. policy to a greater degree than at any time in the post-war world, notably in invading Iraq in 2003 and by supporting Israel. A reliance on Washington that reflected British weakness in securing the large interests at stake. But second, Britain also tried to deepen alliances with the Sunni forces, principally, as ever, the Saudis, who were engaged in an intensifying battle for regional and religious preeminence with their Shia rivals in Tehran, but also the Muslim Brotherhood, an old Sunni Islamist collaborator that was the major opposition to the regime in Egypt. The policy recalled British collusion with the Brotherhood in the 50s, when Britain also faced major challenges to its interests in the Middle East, but lacked allies to promote them. However, British policy could not be simply reduced to a Sunni versus Shia strategy. Some enemies, notably Syria and Hamas, were not Shia forces, while in Iraq, Britain, as we see later, worked through Shia Islamist forces to try to promote its interests. Compounding the problems for Britain was and remains an increasing dependence on imported oil and gas. The most important government document on the subject of Britain's energy security, one of the key phrases in the book, almost entirely passed over by the mainstream media, was produced in February 2003, just as ministers were denying that the anticipated invasion of Iraq had anything to do with oil. Department of Trade and Industry white paper concluded that Britain was set to become a net importer of gas by 2006 and of oil by around 2010. By this time, Britain would very likely be importing around three-quarters of its primary energy needs, while half the world's gas and oil would be coming from countries that are currently perceived as unstable. The paper stated that we need to give greater prominence to strategic energy issues in foreign policy across the government, and that our aims are to maintain strong relations with exporting countries, while in promoting diversity, we will also work to minimize the risk of disruption to supplies from regional disputes. Essentially, the paper was calling for the political status quo to be maintained in many repressive countries and implied that Britain might go to war to keep supplies flowing, which duly happened a few weeks later. I have what I, you know, consider one of the raison d'etre, or the, I don't know if there's the opposite of reason, but, you know, illogic or whatever. But the reason for the gist of all the actions and reactions, the energy security, because the energy runs the system. So there you have it. Let's see. 5 years later, in March 2008, the government produced another key document, the National Security Strategy of the UK. It noted that competition for energy supplies was increasing and that global energy demand would be 50% higher in 2030 than today. Critically, it added, the premium attached to energy security and the rising risk of energy shortages will increase the potential for disputes and conflict. Countries including China and Russia are already making control of energy supply a foreign policy priority. In response to this threat, Britain must guard against the reemergence of a state-led threat through maintaining strong national capabilities, including intelligence, military forces, and nuclear weapons. Britain already had the second highest military budget in the world in cash terms, the report noted. The message was that China, albeit also a trading partner, posed a potential military threat to British interests, along with Russia. While it was obvious where these conflicts were most likely to be played out, Central Asia and the Middle East. Thus, a new factor in British foreign policy planning towards the Middle East in the 21st century was keeping China, as well as a resurgent Russia, out of Britain's traditional client region. All the strategizing that, you know, starts with the resources, but then it gets mixed with religion and military. And I suggest anyone who hasn't to listen to John Trudell's talks on mining mines and how the whole system is the system runs. He makes a phenomenally astute observation that the system runs not only on mining and extractive resources and the energy that comes from that to fuel the system that leaves toxic residue, but that the people, the human beings that participate in that system, and that their participation in that system also leaves a kind of toxic residue, psychological and disconnect from spirituality, soul, etc. So that's one of the, it's probably the most concise explanation I've ever heard of that, and in a kind of holistic way that he sums it up. So this gets into 2005, where the British mention of British interests, the biggest threat, President how you pronounce his name, Ahmadinejad of Iran, and then again all these connections with Western Europe needs. Here he mentions foreign minister, we want Iran to be much more engaged because Western Europe needs Iranian gas very badly. We need to break the Russian monopoly on supplies of gas to Western Europe. So, you know, it's just another way to interpret almost anything you read in the news is to look at who's getting what and why and how it relates to other countries and, that including religions, military, blah, blah, blah. And again, there's so much to cover in this, you know, this whole chapter could be 3 or 4 parts. So if you've got the wherewithal and the, you want to try to wrap your head around all this stuff in depth, I strongly recommend reading the book. It's it flows along pretty well, actually. Again, it's kind of like I mentioned, it's kind of like a, even though I haven't read hardly any, if at all, John le Carré, but it reads like a spy thriller, true life. Probably what he bases a lot of his writings on, and other novels. Okay, jumping ahead here. In 2007, the Bush administration gave the CIA approval to conduct black operations to achieve regime change in Iran, involving a propaganda and disinformation campaign and a strategy to stop Iran's nuclear program. MI6 appears to have been engaged in this campaign, which may have involved passing on to Iran equipment containing viruses and modifications to sabotage its nuclear program. According to Israeli journalist Ronan Bergman, in 2006 and 7, at least 3 planes crashed in Iran belonging to Revolutionary Guards carrying personnel connected with the nuclear program. Britain also collaborated with Israel's secret service, Mossad, to counter Iran. In May 2008, the then head of MI6, Sir John Scarlett, visited Israel to promote what Israeli officials described as a strategic dialogue with Mossad. The following year, in further talks between the two, Scarlett was reportedly told by Mossad chief Meir Dagan that Saudi Arabia had given Israel permission to use its airspace to bomb Iran. To counter Iran and the broader challenges to Britain's energy security, Britain also resorted to constructing what then Prime Minister Tony Blair called an alliance of moderation. In reality, part of London's increasing reliance on Sunni forces in the region. The next section of this chapter is Engaging Moderate Islam. In 2006, Blair delivered what was billed by Downing Street as a major speech on the Middle East to the World Affairs Council in L.A. He noted that, you can note the bullshit yourself here, there is an arc of extremism now stretching across the Middle East and touching, with increasing definition, countries far outside that region. To defeat it, we'll need an alliance of moderation that paints a different future in which Muslim, Jew, and Christian, Arab, and Western, wealthy, and developing nations can progress in peace and harmony with each other. Yeah, the whole thing, basically. Let's see, and it goes on and on. The feudal sheikdoms of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Qatar. Oh, Blair said in the Middle East there was an elemental struggle about the values that will shape our future between reactionary Islam and moderate mainstream Islam. In the moderate camp, where the Palestinian leadership, that is, President Mahmoud Abbas of the Fatah faction, the feudal sheikdoms of the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Qatar, and also as well as Turkey. Also mentioned was Israel, which was viewed as simply defending itself against Hamas and Hezbollah. Saudi Arabia was not mentioned, but could be assumed to be regarded as one of the moderates, i.e. pro-Western forces. In the reactionary camp were Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Taliban, along with the regimes in Syria and Iran. The latter two were a constant source of destabilization and reaction. Damascus for allowing Al-Qaeda militants to enter Iraq, Tehran for supporting extremist Shia there. For them, there is a choice. Come into the international community and play by the same rules as the rest of us, or be confronted. What the British Prime Minister meant was obviously that Iran and Syria should follow Western orders or else. However, the most important part of Blair's speech, missed by the media, was his articulation of how Britain's support for moderate Islam was bound up with its broader foreign policy goals. Blair and Britain and the U.S. should set about empowering moderate Islam, and that a victory for the moderates means an Islam that is open to globalization. However, there is a risk that the world after the Cold War goes back to a global policy based on spheres of influence, and that China will surely be the world's other superpower in 20 to 30 years, along with the more powerful India and Russia. That was a bunch of quotes. In this situation, quotes, the stronger and more appealing our worldview is, the more it is seen as based not just on power but on justice, the easier it will be for us to shape the future in which Europe and the U.S. will no longer economically or politically be transcendent. Long before then, we want moderate mainstream Islam to triumph over reactionary Islam. Blair seemed to be saying that the survival of world hegemony in the world was partly dependent on the triumph of moderate Islam. So all in all, you can see the bloated language that gets used in the news and world to where these people try to, like, you know, shape. They look to the future and here's the enemy and here's the alliance and if we want the world to be a certain way and that kind of stuff that just sends out this message that, you know, honestly sounds good in a lot of ways and sounds like this, you know, father figure voice of authority. And if you have some respect or trust for the system, then hey, it sounds good. But, you know, you gotta look, pardon the plug, you gotta look between the lines. Okay, farther down here, skipping, the British division of the Middle East was essentially the same as Bush's "you're either with us or against us" rhetoric after 9/11, and perhaps not unlike that of the Taliban, for whom the globe was divided into Dar al-Kafur, the lands of infidels or non-Muslim states, Dar al-Munafiqeen, hypocritical religious states like Iran and Turkey, and Dar al-Islam, good Muslim states such as Pakistan and Saudi Arabia. Well, you know, I guess in the food industry there's a war between good and bad cholesterol. It's amazing how they just turn the stuff into these sections and facts, sex and fat and factions, sex and facts and rock and roll. Here's a quote from somebody here. Given that Islamic groups are often less corrupt than the generality of the societies in which they operate, consideration might be given to channeling aid resources through them, so long as sufficient transparency is achieved. So as the last part showed with the London posts, that the sort of using some of these peoples and the resources and to make things run smoothly, to maybe find inside information, it's kind of very finagling and using of people, and as long as a certain amount of transparency is there. But then when it crosses the line, that's when the trouble or the books get written, I guess. And again, this distinguishing, Eastwood and Murphy then noted the differences between the political Islamists who seek change but who do not advocate violence to overthrow regimes, and the jihadists, the Islamic extremists who do. They concluded by stating that G8 governments must now perhaps indirectly get into dialogue with such movements and involve them in the civil society track of the broader Middle East initiative. The U.S. program to supposedly promote democratic reform in the region. Okay. Further on, there's a quote, parliamentary question on the Muslim Brotherhood. We should be extremely careful not to paint all Islamists as violent, because they most certainly are not. And we are ready to engage with organizations and individuals who uphold the values of democracy and use peaceful means to achieve their objectives, challenging their views as necessary. Some of those have been elected, for example, to the Egyptian parliament as independents, but are clearly associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. Our diplomats have met such people on occasion. We do not go out of our way to engage in such meetings, but when they occur, we argue the case for a non-violent approach. We argue against terrorism, and we seek cooperation. And following that, a comment, this was an interesting response, showing first that the government was continuing its long-standing policy of regarding Islamist forces as possible collaborators, and second, implying that the government was perfectly aware of the Brotherhood's links to terrorism. Two more sections to this chapter. The Brotherhood's utility is the next one. I have a note, the pre-U.S. empire here, where there's a message of rooted in Britain's ongoing collaborations with the Islamist right to achieve key British foreign policy goals. A policy consistent with the British strategy of recruiting extremists as informers, as we have seen. And again, the mixed bagginess of, we can certainly dispense with the notion that British engagement with the Brotherhood was due to Whitehall's supposed support for democracy in the Middle East. London had long been opposed to popular governments and movements in the region, largely since they tended to be more anti-Western than the authoritarian pro-Western regimes. Britain likely saw the Brotherhood, as it did from the 1950s to the 70s, as a counter to the secular nationalist forces in Egypt and the region, notably the kifaya, means enough, KIFAYA, grassroots movement of secular nationalists and leftists, which emerged in 2004 as posing a popular challenge to the Mubarak regime. And skipping around, opposition activities in Syria were clearly mounted from London and were apparently tolerated by the British authorities. Then Syrian Brotherhood leader Ali so-and-so, who moved to London in 2000 after spending 20 years in Jordan, said in 2005 that we have members in Syria, but we would avoid giving these activities any identifiable structure. By late 2008, however, Britain, together with the U.S., changed tack in relations with Syria and began to try to court the regime, probably mainly to further isolate Iran. British ministers visited Damascus in 2008 and 9, and Syrian Foreign Minister Walid al-Mualem visited London in 2009. David Miliband now saw the Syrian regime as a source of stability in the Middle East, but particularly striking was his view that it's very important that we continue to engage countries like Syria, which wants to be a secular state at the heart of a stable Middle East. Thus, Syria could act as a secular counter to Islamists in the region, although it remained unclear the extent to which London was also continuing to cultivate the Muslim Brotherhood opposition. And here I have noted the modus operandi. Given the Brotherhood's utility to British officials, who have a long history of working with virtually anyone who will help them achieve specific objectives, the organization's links to terrorism could be largely overlooked by Whitehall, except to the degree that collaboration was bad for public relations and for relations with the Mubarak regime. The trio of actors whom Blair identified as the chief proponents of terrorism were all groups the British government had helped cultivate since the late 1940s. The Muslim Brotherhood, albeit offshoots, with whom the Foreign Office had just stepped up contacts. Wahhabi extremists in Saudi Arabia, with whom Blair and his predecessors had dealt happily for years. And the Pakistani madrasas, nurtured by further Pakistani leaders, consistently supported by Britain. Despite Blair's articulation of the need to empower the moderates, the reality was that Britain had long been colluding with the extremists. All these comments suggested that British officials and ministers believed that the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots were not purely moderate or reformist, and in this attitude they were similar to their predecessors in the 1950s, who recognized that they were collaborating with terrorists. Of course, the Muslim Brotherhood was by now a very different organization than in the 50s. It was clearly much more complex and diverse, a network with branches in around 70 countries, and contained a wide variety of political views. Many Brotherhood figures had renounced violence in favor of participation in electoral processes, and the organization stood out from Al-Qaeda, which had long opposed it precisely for its lack of militancy. So again, how much militant one is, how much not, how much one wants to get elected. The last show mentioned something about 80 organizations throughout the world. So the layers of this stuff are quite widespread. And again, he follows the threads throughout the book, Curtis, mentioning the collusion to overthrow Nasser, the president of Egypt, back in the 50s. So you see the ongoing threads as the players change and the various sects evolve and change and morph, and enemies and friends enemies morph. So it's this ongoing, in this sense, I would use the term war theater as accurate. The ever-turning London-Riyadh axis. The British government continued to see Saudi Arabia not only as a supplier of oil and buyer of British weapons, but also as a Sunni counter to a resurgent Shia Iran, part indeed of the supposed alliance of moderation. This continuing support for Riyadh was instructive in light of what the Saudis were actually up to. A summer 2002 UN report on the financing of Al-Qaeda asserted that $16 million was sent to bin Laden's organization from four sources in Saudi Arabia after the September 2001 attacks. Nearly a year after 9/11, the CIA was stating that there is incontrovertible evidence that there is support for these terrorists within the Saudi government. And here I have a note: with U.S. empire and Saudi business, the global war of terror is bullshit. Let's see, I'll read the section. However, not all the new laws have been implemented, and few punitive actions have been taken against individuals financing terrorism. Moreover, while some efforts have been made to clamp down on domestic extremists, little has been done to stop their export, while Saudi money has continued to flow around the world in support of Islamist causes. A U.S. estimate from 2005 was that the Saudis were sending between $300 and $600 million around the world every year to fund radical religious organizations. A report sponsored by the Council on Foreign Relations in the U.S. noted that this massive spending is helping to create the next generation of terrorists. I mean, you don't have to read the between the lines if you read the quotes. One Washington think tank estimated that the decades-long Saudi campaign to promote Wahhabism around the world has spent a massive $50 billion and was the largest worldwide propaganda campaign ever mounted. It has involved the building of 1,500 mosques, 2,200 colleges and schools, and 200 Islamic centers, some of which have acted as support networks for the jihad movements. By nearly 2008, 5 years after the Saudis began limited action against terrorist financing and activities in the country, the Bush administration's top Treasury counterterrorism official Stuart Levy told the Senate committee that Saudi Arabia remained the world's leading source of money for al-Qaeda and other extremists. And a little further on, the official enemy Iran has been constantly accused by London and Washington of helping the insurgents in Iraq, which has been equally constantly reported by the media. Yet Saudi Arabia has provided the bulk of foreign jihadists fighting there. By late 2006, Saudi citizens were providing millions of dollars in funding to Sunni insurgents in Iraq, much of it used to buy weapons. Further on, according to a U.S. government consultant quoted by investigative journalist Seymour Hersh, the Saudis assured the White House that this time they will keep a close eye on the religious fundamentalists in Iraq, and that if they're going to throw bombs, it will be at Hezbollah, Iran, and the Syrians, and not at U.S. forces. Such Saudi involvement in the Iraqi insurgency amounts to a tacit proxy war against Iran, in which the U.S. and Britain at least acquiesced. Britain's relationship with Saudi Arabia under New Labour, the product of decades of careful nurturing by Whitehall, remained very deep. For example, the Foreign Office's Engaging with the Islamic World program, that's the title of it, Engaging with the Islamic World, which promotes outreach to the Muslim Brotherhood and other organizations, also includes a little notice project called Two Kingdoms, Friendship and Partnership. Launched in 2005, the project aims to enhance UK relations with Saudi Arabia around a shared reform agenda, including discussions on subjects ranging from national security and terrorism to employment and education. The symbolism of the two kingdoms of the UK and Saudi Arabia sharing the same challenges is powerful in these times of misunderstanding, the Foreign Office has noted. And a little further on, he went so far as to praise, this is Jack Straw, Foreign Secretary in 2006, praised the kingdom for its striking counterterrorism successes over the last 2 years and for winning hearts and minds. And the mobilization of Saudi society against the extremists, he went so far as to praise the Wahhabi fundamentalists for their leadership in the Muslim world and for having faced down the perversion of religion, which is the seedbed of terrorism. Yeah, that's a great phrase there. Face down the perversion of religion, which is the seedbed of terrorism. Well, actually some of that is true. And on forward, the Foreign Secretary was simply echoing British planners nearly a century before who saw a British-backed Saudi Arabia's control of Mecca and Medina as useful for British imperial purposes. Guard to the holy places. I mean, you got to think that some of these people, you know, when they're in there and they're talking about holy places and resources and energy and its effect on the world, and you got to think some of these people are just intoxicated with the power of this, and that, you know, they actually might think they are actually doing stuff, you know, to have a positively change, help the world, however you call that. And here I have a couple. Here I have geopolitical bada bings. We'll set this up with the whole paragraph. Apologias for the Saudis reached right across the mainstream political spectrum. In 2006, for example, the All-Party Foreign Affairs Committee conducted an inquiry into the foreign policy aspects of the war against terrorism. The group of MPs failed to notice that Britain's Saudi ally had been the major sponsor for approximately three decades of the terrorism it was meant to be investigating. There's the geopolitical bada-bing. Instead, the committee concluded that Saudi Arabia was taking very seriously the causes of terrorism in the process of extremist recruitment and was pursuing crucial long-term policies to tackle the causes of terrorism. Indeed, Britain could usefully learn from Saudi Arabia's experience in this field, highlighting the two-way nature of cooperation with the kingdom. Britain continued to sign stupendous arms agreements with the kingdom. And my favorite phrase-wise group, notably the Al-Yamama 3 deal in December 2005 to supply Typhoon aircraft and other equipment worth an initial £8 billion, but possibly up to £40 billion. Winding down with this chapter, a couple few pages here. In 2006 and 7, Brown and his then-deputy of the Treasury, yep, I told you the political bada bings here, this guy's actual name, Ed Balls, delivered half a dozen speeches all on the same theme, how to make the City of London the favored destination for Islamic finance. Brown noted in 2006, for example, that following his recent visit to Saudi Arabia, he saw how the city is becoming an investment location of choice for the Middle East and Muslim countries all over the world. Ed Balls noted in 2007 that there were $250 billion worth of funds in the Islamic finance system, which was forecast to grow 15% annually, and that we want to see more of this business coming to London. Britain was, Balls said, the largest European investor in Oman, the largest non-Arab investor in Egypt, and the second largest investor in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, with 35 trade offices in Muslim countries around the world. Doing that kind of finance and stuff takes, wait for it, takes balls. Okay, I guess we'll just read the last page and a half here, because otherwise you might miss something here. A little bit longer and detailed with this show, but, you know, the chapter gets to a lot of stuff and some good stuff. Good, in quotes, stuff. At the same time, the City of London, this was around with all the finance stuff going on, at the same time, the City of London was seeking to showcase itself to Gulf investors amid a financial boom that was sweeping the Middle East before the global financial crisis struck in 2008. Awash with cash from record oil prices, the six countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Qatar, and Oman, had launched massive public and private investment drives to raise oil and gas output in developed sectors such as tourism and financial services. Western banks and companies have been rushing to the region to capitalize on the business opportunities, the Financial Times reported. Oil-rich Middle East investment funds now have $1.5 trillion under their management, while the London City has become the world's central petrodollar recycling plant, where oil dollars are invested, lent or traded, and pumped back into the global economy. These petrodollars have emerged as one of the key drivers of the international equity markets, as well as a main source of liquidity and financing for hedge funds, private equity, currency traders, and governments. If that doesn't show how the oil and finance and all those markets that I don't understand how they work, but get the gist that they are all tied together in some form, and how the system, you know, the system hinges on this stuff. Saudi Arabia's importance to Britain also involved its commitment to keeping the oil market well supplied and, as far as possible, price stable. When the oil price shot up in early 2008 to over 100 a barrel, sparking major fuel prices rises in Britain and worldwide, Gordon Brown did as his predecessors in the Conservative and Labour governments of 1973-5. He not only visited Saudi Arabia to persuade the Saudis to increase oil supply and reduce prices, he also offered Britain as a location for the Saudis and other oil producers to invest their very substantial revenues. So now you know, if you didn't already, that when you get in your car and go to the store and you notice the price of gas has gone up, the price of gas has gone down, the price of gas has gone up, the price of gas has gone down, now you know that there's some quite a litany of illogic behind that, that there's a lot of reasons behind it. And okay, actually, last two paragraphs of this chapter, these policies ensured that the British economy was set to become ever more intertwined with Islamic financial system, in turn deepening British dependence on the state champions of extremist Islam, the Saudis, and Britain's other traditional allies in the region, the Gulf Sheikdoms. The whole strategy depended, however, on Middle Eastern regimes and companies being willing to invest in Britain, which in turn depended on British ministers being sufficiently sycophantic towards their feudal clients and on those rulers maintaining their power and on thus preserving the traditional political and economic order in the Middle East. The new prize for the city was only attainable with the cooperation of the leading forces in the Islamic world. It is hard not to view the outreach to the Muslim Brotherhood and indeed the policies that contribute to Londonistan as part of the same strategy. Severely muddying the waters, however, were Iraq and Afghanistan, where British policy was being further challenged and which again reveals the resort to working with Islamist forces to achieve objectives. So all the financing and the to kind of sum up, the economy tied in with the resources, much of it hinging on the Middle East with the major players of Saudi Arabia, Britain, and the U.S. and loosely considering that you have all these religious factions here or there, that loosely considering that all the religious factions are part of the mix, it becomes a kind of economical theo-fascist quagmire of the oil corporations, the state players, and the economy and the religiosity. So it's a whole big mess that hopefully that at some level you want to run peacefully so there's not more chaos, and yet the other global angle going on is to switch to renewables and sustainables. So when I think about not just how does that change on a local level as far as all the most of the gas stations converting to electric chargers or most of the houses converting to solar or however, to think of all these regions and all the people and all the jobs, and from the oil rig guy to the number cruncher in the office in London to whomever, you've got a whole system, a geopolitical system caught up in this 75-100 years of running along these lines of essentially the oil getting transported and this and that. So the change to make the changes is complex. But some level, we hear Mother Earth crying that it's got to be done. So thanks for listening. And chapter 19 is going to be the allied to the enemy, Iraq and Afghanistan. So have a good one. Be well.